Hello and welcome to this conference. My name is Jai Bristow and I'm one of your hosts. And today I am delighted to be welcoming two wonderful speakers. We have Dr. Alex Ian Taffy, a family therapist, sex therapist, gender specialist, and award-winning author. Welcome, Alex.
Thank you for having me here today. So excited to be having this conversation with you and MJ.
Hi, great to have you back. And we have Dr. Meg John Barker, an international renowned speaker and writer with a background in therapy, academics, and activism. Welcome, MJ.
Hi.
Lovely to see you both again. So we did a conversation together in the Heal Toxic Relationship Super Conference, where we talked about how to understand your toxic relationships, right? And in today's topic, we're going to talk a little bit more about your upcoming book, How to Understand Your Relationships, focusing specifically on relational trauma.
Yeah.
So do you want to get us started by telling us what is relational trauma?
Absolutely. Are you okay if I get started, yeah. MJ? A little transparent process. I think relational trauma can be so many different things, which is why it's a little tricky, right? Because in a way, I think there is a level of relational trauma within dominant culture, right? Like capitalism, I think, you know, it's not very relational, for example. And so that creates kind of historical and intergenerational trauma that gets passed down about how we do relationships and how we treat one another. But of course, there's also interpersonal relationship trauma. So maybe things that we've experienced kind of growing up, and now we've experienced relationships, and then we bring that into our parenting, we bring that into our friendships, we bring that into our intimate partnerships. Because when MJ and I talk about relationships, we're really talking about all relationships, right? So not just intimate relationships, but also our relationships with our kids, if we're parents or caregivers, our relationships with our neighbors, our relationship with our friends, our relationship with the ecosystem around us, right? Our relationship with our pets. And we try to meet our relational needs in a lot of different ways as humans. And that trauma piece is really, sometimes I describe it as like, you know, those very thick window glass panes that you can have in the shower, that have decorations are really thick. And so you can still see through that glass pane, but everything is distorted. And I think trauma can be like that, right? It kind of distorts our experience of relationships. It impacts our thoughts and feelings. The last thing I'll say about relationship trauma is that trauma can seem like a really big word. And I know as a therapist, sometimes clients really react to it. If I say trauma, they're like, I'm fine. I don't have trauma, or, you know, my childhood was fine. And I think that we use this big word, but actually trauma can be many things. Trauma can also come from, you know, parents that are too busy surviving under capitalism to adequately meet the attachment needs of their kids, right? Or parents who have their own complex PTSD or trauma from, having been brought up in a war zone, for example, or having their own attachment issues, right? And even though they're wonderful parents and caregivers, their nervous system goes into fight, flight, or freeze, right? In a certain way that then kind of impacts how, as children, we're kind of brought up and how we can manage or not manage different nervous system states very well. And then when you bring all of that into relating, you can have what I sometimes call a trauma party, which is when one or more people are kind of activated with each other, right? And now we're no longer relating. We're just having what I call a trauma party, which is we're having a mixture of like fight, flight, freeze, fawning, and are we actually really present and relating with one another? I don't know if you want to add anything to that, MJ, in terms of what relational trauma is and how it might show up.
Yeah, I feel like just again acknowledging what tender territory this is and how much this stuff is present for us, you know, like some of just the most painful things in my life and most of the lives of the people I know is relational trauma, because we put so much, you know, relationships are so hugely important to us just as human beings. And then in our kind of current culture, we put so much stress on relationships as the thing that's going to kind of save us and you know, love will save the day and people will complete us and all of this. So there's so much pressure on love, and often it is a place where initially we can experience, you know, so many good things and almost feel the absence of trauma. So it's just incredibly hard when we realize these traumatic kind of patterns have found their way into our relationships, like you say, with ourselves, with intimate partners, with our kids, our parents, friends, colleagues. It's sometimes really hard to notice that that's even happened, because those things seem quite normal to us if those are familiar from our childhoods. Or that when we do realise how bad it's got, it can be really shocking and kind of re-traumatising to realise we've kind of gone there again. So I think that's the sort of territory we're in, and how much it relates to emotions as well. Like, it's, I guess, how would I know that I'm in a traumatic relationship? It's often, you know, because either there's quite a lot of under emotion, you know, there's kind of a dissociation or repression of feelings, or often that feelings have become, you know, very overwhelming and almost unbearable, at least at times, whether that's feelings of kind of fear, shame, rage, loneliness, loss, those kind of feelings are kind of through the roof. And so it's sort of, that's a real sign that something about how we were brought up in terms of feeling is kind of in play here, as well as how our wider culture treats emotions. So it's sort of coming to better relationship with ourselves and with others is what we're in this for, I guess, when we're tackling our relationship trauma.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you both for bringing in these like really important topics and also like great images. Like, Alex, I loved how you talk about, you know, that sort of like thick glass and that, you know, that sort of misty glass, and that yes. Trauma has that thing of it's sometimes really hard to see through it. And like, if I keep that analogy, sometimes, you know, if that's all you've known, then your eyes get used to it and you don't even realize that you're not seeing clearly anymore, right? And then that trauma exactly. Party, yeah, and that yeah. Trauma party you were describing, like sadly I can relate too well, right, when everything gets activated. And then MJ, I loved as well how you were talking about, yeah, recognizing, because that was going to be one of my questions, right? Because you're both talking about how complex it is and how, how much it's integrated into our lives often, you know, especially because relational trauma particularly starts a lot of the time from very early on, starts from, you know, from childhood, starts to do with our conditioning around yes. our early family and caregivers, and also cultural conditioning, you know, it's all, so it's so hard to see. And so I appreciated you bringing in that element around the emotions, right? And as a way of recognizing if we're experiencing this relational trauma. Alex, I was wondering if you had anything else you wanted to bring in specifically around recognizing that, not just what it is, but recognizing that we have it or that we're in a state of trauma in our relationships.
Yes, that's always very tricky, right? Because like you said, if we are immersed somewhere in that moment where we can even feel very grounded and very clear, right? Like, I see very clearly and I feel like I'm right, you know, and this is wrong and what's happening, you know, it's objectively wrong and the other person is at fault. We can feel so righteous within ourselves. I definitely, I know I've had those moments where I'm like, I'm seeing the pattern clearly. I know that this is what's happening and it's not about me. And then I'm like, oh, I'm gonna moment. Actually, this is about me. And I am kind of seeing things through that kind of misty glass, or things are not quite as clear as they seem. And sometimes it takes another person's perspective. And so it can be very tricky. And I think things that are helpful is having a solid network of friends and trusted people, or even, you know, a therapist or a close friend or somebody who knows us, where we can kind of check in sometimes, right? But things to watch out for are things like, you know, all or nothing thinking, right? Things are this way or that way, right? If we are kind of engaging in all or nothing thinking patterns, that's probably, there's something to be questioned. If we feel 100% sure that it's all the other person's fault, That's also a red flag, right? I often say it takes two or three or four to tango, whichever combo and whichever dance we're doing, right? Not all dances are like just dyadic partner dances, right? And so whichever dance we're in, it takes all of us to contribute. And if I'm so certain that I'm doing nothing wrong, well, maybe I can be a little bit more curious about what's the other person's experience, because also trauma makes us self-focused, right? To survive, we need to focus on ourselves. And so if we're so self-focused that we lost perspective about what's going on with the other person or the other people, we lost curiosity, that's probably a good sign that there's some trauma reaction at play. And then the only other piece I'll bring in is getting to know our nervous system, right? Getting to know our nervous system responses. Like, do I know what fight feels like in my body? Do I know what flight feels like in my body? Do I know what freeze feels like in my body? And do I know what fawning, you know, people pleasing feels like in my body? You know, those kind of four major trauma responses. And recognizing that they might change as well. Maybe I knew what those felt like in my body 10 years ago, but now I'm in a different place and those feel differently. So that there's also a constant relearning that we need to do it about ourselves, because also we show up differently in different relationships, right? And so those responses might look very differently now than they did 10 years ago or 20 years ago. And I know this might sound like a lot of work, and I also know that some of our brains don't kind of are not always necessarily very good at interoception, the ability to perceive our inner state. And so it is like a muscle that we're constantly exercising. And for some of us, we need to put a little bit more of a workout in that muscle than other people, right? But it is possible to, I think, kind of recognize some of those things within ourselves.
Lots of things pinging, and some of it I'll go into a bit more when we talk about plurality, but I was struck about the all or nothing and good, bad. You know, a lot of the theories I'm playing with at the moment, they're about the kind of selves, the parts of the self or the selves that we're in relational trauma or in trauma in general, have this very good, bad thinking. So as well as you saying, Alex, you know, if you feel like I'm completely right, I'm completely good, the other person's all bad, being a sign. The flip is also a sign, you know, where you think I'm completely bad and this other person's all good, you know, which we can have in a really wonderful way in the early stages of a relationship. But it's also a little red flag flying, you know, when we have that, because if we really think this other person's all good, and certainly if we think they're all good and we're all bad, you know, and if they start to say things to us and we completely accept their truth over ours, that's another sign. You know, there's lots of different ways these dynamics can play out. But I would say when you're in blame or shame, you know, completely, that's a sign. And the other thing I just wanted to pick up on was your thing about, you know, kind of building the relationship support system, because we're not all, because of where these things are coming from, we're not always best placed ourselves to know, like, is this relationship a good idea for me? Might there be some of my old patterns? And unfortunately, a kind, you know, kind of in the culture, the dominant culture we're in, there's often a lot of pressure to kind of keep the doors closed on our relationships, to keep these things private, not to tell people about them. And two of the things I guess I've really started to do in terms of my own relationship trauma and hopefully not perpetuating it further is to make sure that anyone I form any kind of new relationship with knows the doors are going to be wide open. I'm going to be talking to a lot of people, therapists, friends, you know, often Alex, you know, about how my relationships are going, you know, and if somebody's not open to the doors being open, then I'm going to step back from that relationship. And the other thing would be going fairly slowly so that, again, I can keep feeling into how this is rather than kind of going really fast into relating, where I might not notice some of these signs until it's, you know, not too late, but until the dynamics have become really entrenched. Yeah.
Yeah, I love that you said that, absolutely, because often I think we go into that place of what's wrong with you or what's wrong with me when it comes to trauma and relationship, right? And I think a really useful question to ask is what's happening between us right now, right? I think it can be so easy. Trauma really pushes us, right? To be like, well, what's wrong with me? What's wrong with you? That shame and blame game. Mm. But when we can be curious about what is happening between us, what is this dynamic? Does this dynamic feel familiar to you? Does it feel familiar to me? Do we remind each other of specific people? Do we understand who we're drawn to and why? Usually that imprint is set pretty early on in our lives, right? If somebody is emotionally unavailable, it's like catnip for me, right? It's like I recognize that pattern. I feel that intimacy pattern from my childhood. And so do I know that about myself? And can I be curious about what is happening between us? What's happening for you? When we lose that curiosity and we go into the blame and shame game, then we know that we moved into relational trauma territory as far as I'm concerned. Mm.
Absolutely. Thank you both for bringing in this super important piece, right? And I really like the way that, you know, the idea of blaming is making it all the other person's fault, shaming is making it all our fault. And as you both have mentioned, or as you've all mentioned, you know, that is very much, it's something that is all too familiar, and we can fluctuate between both. And sometimes, you know, sometimes it's all your fault, and then it's, oh my god, I'm terrible, it's all my fault. And there were some really key elements you all talked about in, you know, that I can't remember exactly what you said, but there were some fantastic elements there around recognizing the toxicity of that thinking, of if we take the word of the other as truth over what we're feeling, for example, that's a major red flag. So I think there's really great material in what you've just shared. You touched upon towards the end there, MJ, about that slowing down piece. And so I'm wondering if you could say a little bit more about that slowing down.
Yeah, definitely. And I think, you know, that it sort of relates to something as well. I was thinking when you're talking that we explore in the book is sort of also about relational fit. You know, we have such a one size fits all idea of what a romantic relationship looks like, what a friendship looks like. We get that from our culture. And then we often have our own individual scripts of like, this is what a partner should be. This is what a friend should be. This is what a colleague should be. You know, and I think those really can further relational trauma because there's no flexibility. And there's sort of this idea that if we connect, then we must become partners, friends, colleagues, and it must look a certain way. And I think one of the things is moving away from that to a much more flexible and, you know, slower kind of model where it's like, well, you know, we write about this in the book, Alex, and I had exactly this experience of getting together as partners. And then it was like, that didn't really work with us. And then we found our way to colleagues, and then we found our way to really close friendship and colleague relationship over like the 20 years or so we've known each other. And I think, you know, because we're all different in so many ways, we bring different trauma patterns, we have different neurodivergences, we have different relationship styles, monogamous, non-monogamous, you know, all kinds of ways of doing friendship and colleague relationships. Like this idea that it's actually about finding, you know, where's the fit, where's the overlap here, what's the container or the conditions that makes this relationship work best, rather than that, again, that all or nothing, either we're partners or we're nothing. Or even worse, either we're partners or you're my enemy forever. You know, it's like, so slow is kind of having that openness to flexibility over time, recognizing everyone's going to change, really being up for exploring what are our patterns, what are our neurodivergences, what are our preferred ways of relating, finding the overlaps, you know, moving back, moving forward. But also for me, as somebody who got into relationships very fast, you know, it was always like, oh, I feel a connection with you. Next thing, I'm in love with you, or next thing, you're my best friend, you know, like maybe having met someone once or twice. I just thought that connection meant, you know, that's good. And sometimes, you know, that gives you that bit of a honeymoon period where, you know, you have this new shiny friendship, you have this new shiny partnership, and all the fear and shame kind of drops off for a while. And you think like, this is amazing. And then those patterns really sneak back in, and often they really come back in because some element of maybe why you were drawn to that person was because it was familiar patterns there. Not always, but sometimes for sure. So now I'm kind of like a real advocate for me, at least, but for others who find a useful idea of like this slow relating, like, you know. And I read some research recently about the average length of meeting with somebody that would take for someone to become acquaintance to friend, friend to closer friend, close friend to, you know, one of your best people in your life. And you know, it was like 90 odd times you need to meet someone to go to that level. And, you know, and it's like, well, yeah, could we not necessarily impose that model on everyone at all, but, you know, just invite that that's really okay to take your time to really feel into like, how am I around that person? And again, maybe have some conscious conversations about, you know, what does friendship mean? If it's a burgeoning friendship, you know, what does friendship mean to you? And, you know, what are your boundaries around that? What are your, you know, wants and needs around that? Rather than just like, oh yes, we connected, we're best friends. And then, oh dear, okay, we had pretty different understanding of what that meant. And that's felt like, say, as a betrayal by someone or as an abandonment by someone. And again, you come, this sort of a re-traumatizing experience rather than what could have been a really healthy and happy relationship.
Yeah, I love everything you're saying, MJ. And I want to also add how challenging that is for some of us as somebody who's like, A, comes from like a culture where actually, like, you know, in Southern Italy, especially, you can just like connect so quickly and feel so intensely, right? We've had like this deep conversation on this like 1 hour long bus ride, and now we are besties and we have exchanged numbers, right? And we are connected. And so, like, I know that for me, the slow relating, I totally see the value of it. And it goes against like everything in me culturally, and also everything in me connected to my anxious attachment style, right? Yeah. I'm an anxiously attached person by and large. And so, you know, when we are anxiously attached, sometimes we want to kind of bypass and accelerate, you know, commitment, because that makes us feel secure, right? And actually, you know, I've really had to learn over time, over the last 5 decades of life, that you really cannot bypass and accelerate that. Yeah. And that for me, it's like this both and dance, right? I do feel an immediacy of connection culturally. I can totally go to the place of like, we're besties now. And also, like, can I have a both end, right? Can I recognize this cultural pattern around relating fast? Can I recognize my anxiously attached nature? And can I have compassion for myself and also maintain kind of the hold the relationship with some open hands, right? Maybe I am feeling this intensity and I'm okay with that. And also I recognize that there are certain things that build over time, right? Trust builds over time. Yeah. You know, like we, like you said, we have 20 years of relating to one another in lots of different ways, which is amazing. And partially, I think what enabled us to stay in relationship over 20 years is having both that self-compassion and compassion, right? Hang on a minute, okay, I'm feeling upset or this is happening, you know, when we broke up, but I'm also curious about what's happening for you, right? I'm also curious about what's happening between us. And yeah. I'm also curious about what's happening around us, because also relationships don't happen in a vacuum, right? Mm-hmm. They happen in the context of our lives. And sometimes there are stressors in our lives that really contribute to putting pressure on that relationship, mm-hmm. right? And so it's really, sometimes I'm just amazed that we manage to relate to one another at all in the world, right? Because it's so hard. And I think we talk about relationships like they're this easy thing, but actually that they're really hard. And in a way, they're harder because we are under pressure from capitalism. We do have all these expectations of what relationship should look like, right? What love should look like. But if we really approach love and relationship from a lens of I really care about this person and I really care about their well-being, then I think that shifts the relationship, right? Because then it's not about I see this person as an object or I see this person as somebody who can meet my needs, right? But actually, hang on a minute, relationships are about what we create between us. And I think that slowness allows us to explore what is it that we're weaving between us and does that need to change? And and it's okay for relationships to change over time, but trauma doesn't want that. Trauma wants absolutes and trauma wants speed, and trauma makes us feel like everything is urgent, right? And so that's the other thing. If I feel a sense of urgency, I probably know it's trauma, because if there's no fire, blood, or flood, like one of my teachers, Kathy Kane, says, there's actually no crisis. Like, right, then it's trauma. Then I'm feeling a sense of urgency, but there is objectively no urgency, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but I love, Alex, that you're, you know, and what we emphasize in the book too is this is incredibly hard. This is what we're up against. You know, we're almost like programmed on every level, from our culture to our upbringing, that we should treat people as things, you know, as objects for us, and try and possess them. And, you know, it's in every pop song, you know, you belong to me and all of this. And it's like that actually the work of treating someone else as another free human being who we value their well-being over what they are to us. You know, I think it's put across like that would be an easy thing to do, to sort of to actually care about others. Actually caring about others is one of the hardest things you'll ever learn how to do. You know, it's a reason why whole kind of world religions and philosophies are devoted to, you know, how on earth would we actually manage to be caring and compassionate and kind with other people? Because it actually is, yeah, really hard not to just see people through the trauma lens or the lens of what they are to us. And that's, you know, that's what we're doing here. It's also a real spiritual journey, I think, in terms of learning how to relate well with others, with ourselves, and with the world.
Absolutely. I think it really interrogates what are our values around love and care, right? And I think that our culture is not well when it comes about to relationship. And so when the culture is not well, when there is this cloud of trauma in the culture around relating, how can we find our way to this slow, beautiful, slow, intentional relating? And also slow doesn't mean, you know, one of the things I've learned is slow doesn't have to mean a lack of commitment. Slow just means like, can we be slow enough that we can really get to know each other so that I can love you the way you want to be loved and makes you feel loved, and you can love me in the way that makes me feel cared for and loved. And that's going to take a minute to figure out, even for the speediest of us. It's going to take a moment to learn each other.
But it doesn't preclude those moments of beautiful like presence and connection with strangers. Mm-hmm. I guess, again, it's such a work progress for us both, but I'm really with that. How can I be completely like present and available to those beautiful kind of fleeting moments with a stranger without like them or me putting on this cultural kind of piece about it's got to escalate, it's got to suddenly become, you know, it's got to have that urgency. You know, can we just be open to like fleeting moments with somebody, or a comet star relationship where we meet once a year and have an amazing time? Or can we be open to all these different ways of relating where we can be super present and super connected without having to put it on the kind of relationship escalator of getting more and more intense over time, or, you know, making that person a thing for us because we had one good experience with them?
Yeah, thank you both for bringing in this like really, again, important piece. And I really appreciate how you talk about the value of slow relating and seeing what it is and isn't, right? And then also recognizing how hard that is, and how like the ways our brains are wired, the way trauma works, means that it's a nice idea, but it's really hard. So bringing in that both and, yes, being able to like hit the brakes and take one's time and do slow relating is really beneficial and really supportive. And it can be incredibly difficult when we're not conditioned to do that and our brains aren't wired to do that, right? So, and especially with trauma, like you say, there is that urgency, and we are speaking specifically about relational trauma. So if you are in a relationship where you meet someone and you have that urgency feeling, yes, it's probably to do with your trauma. It's probably to do with your patterns. It's probably, you know, and that's okay. There's nothing wrong with that or with you. And like you all have said about bringing in that compassion and recognizing that, and that the both and I was really struck as well about like the relational fit you were speaking about, and about how, you know, this ideas and expectations of what a relationship should look like and how it should progress, and all these shoulds, and this theme of should has come up a lot on this conference and a lot of my interviews. And I was actually talking to Akilah Riley Richardson actually earlier today in another interview about the glitch and the glitch is an acronym she uses where she's talking about, you know, the glitch, a bit like the glitch in the Matrix, right? Where all these shoulds and expectations, where something like subverts that and suddenly doesn't go in that way. But glitch is also an acronym and an opportunity through which to discover something different, to heal, to find the juiciness, and to reconnect with life as a, and to with oneself, as opposed to how we think life should be lived. So I really recommend people go check out that talk as well, if they haven't had the opportunity to do so yet. Now, there's been some fantastic elements brought in already. And Alex, I was really struck by what you were saying about, you know, instead of asking what have you done wrong or what's wrong with you or what have I done wrong or what's wrong with me, it's asking what's happening between us. So it's not asking what's wrong with our relationship either. It's asking what's happening, but taking that even one step further. So it's what's happening within, between us, whoever us is, right? But also what's happening with you, what's happening in you right now, not what's wrong with you or why have you done this and you are wrong, but like what's going on for you right now? Like what is being activated? What's being triggered? What patterns are coming up? Who are you seeing me as in this moment? Like, and really being curious, right? And then same thing, question, having that, bringing that same curiosity to oneself. Okay, what's going on in me right now? Why am I acting this way? What is the history? What is the pattern? So again, looking at it all with from that place of curiosity of what's happening between us and why is it happening between us, probably because of something that's happening in me and something that's happening in you, and you can be one, two, multiple people, and you know. And so I think that that's really helpful in when our relational trauma is activated, or when we're, you know, when we're aware that it's something that's happening, right? Like, why do I feel uncomfortable in this moment? Not immediately because the other, whoever or however many people the other is, but okay. And then from there, we can have the questions and the conversations, which can bring clarity. And that's when we see, is it a relationship that we are able to work on together that can become healing? Or is it a relationship that is just re-traumatizing and there's fundamental either incompatibilities or lack of capacity or lack of whatever it is to actually, you know, heal it, and instead it becomes re-traumatizing because often it's one or the other. So I'd really like to explore that, like how about having those conversations, having tools, having the opportunity when we recognize our trauma and our trauma responses in a relationship, and again, relationship in the broadest sense of the term, like how do we then figure out how to take the path of healing as opposed to re-traumatizing?
I love that question. I think one of the things that's really important to recognize is also which parts of ourselves are getting activated. I think whether we are plural or singlet, so whether we see ourselves as a singular self or as plural selves, we all have different parts, right? And of course, if we're plural, then our parts have parts, right? But if we look at it from an internal family system perspective, or just from a systemic perspective, or even a cultural perspective, not every culture look at the self as a singular entity, mm-hmm. right? But first of all, recognizing which parts of me are getting activated in this relationship. So for example, is it my child self that's really feeling abandoned over and over? Is it my teenage self that's getting really activated and is getting pretty protective? Often our teenage parts can be a little bit more fighty, a little bit more mouthy. You know, often I ask clients, okay, let's, you know, if I'm working with a couple or a polycule, let's take a break. How old is everybody right now? And people are like, well, I'm like, how old do you feel in this moment, right? I know it seems like an odd question. Can we ask ourselves, okay, how old do I feel right now, right? You know, recently I've been feeling very teenage-like in a new relationship, which can be exhilarating, right? All this like new relationship energy, but also there is like a, you know, developmentally, adolescents are kind of, everything is urgent, everything is big, everything is like now, right? And so if we can recognize how old are the parts of ourselves that are getting activated, we can also slow down and be like, hey, my child self feels really abandoned when you need to take a break during conflict. And I wonder if there is a different way we can approach that, right? And I think that is helpful because then we're starting to recognize that also we don't always operate in the same way with everybody, right? We are different in different relationships because different people bring out different aspects of ourselves or different people within our system, you know? And I think that it's important to recognize that because when we can recognize that, and then we can recognize that's also happening for the other person or people we're relating with, again, we can go back to that place of curiosity of like, hey, maybe we're actually a really good fit in terms of peer to peer, but our child selves are actually not fitting very well. So what's happening there? Or our teenage selves are not fitting very well. When we are in our adult place, we can really connect in one way, but then there are way some other times when we don't connect in that way. So what's happening? But if we look at ourselves as like one singular block was always the same in all circumstances, I don't think that's as helpful. I don't know. MJ, you're so much better than I am on this aspect. So I'm sure that you have many wise things to add to this.
Oh, thanks, Alex. But no, that was really great. Yeah, I mean, really for us, we're a plural system. So there's five of us in here at the moment. And yeah, relational trauma was really why we decided about 5 years ago, 4 years ago, to kind of take a step back from a lot of relating in order to do a lot of inner work relating within that system. And I think, you know, again, as you say, for everyone, really, some kind of plural work or parts work or voice dialogue, it's called. There's just so many different systems for understanding this. And recently, the 12-step programs, a lot of them are doing a lot of stuff around reparenting, the ACA approach. So whatever language people use or whatever way you find towards it, just this sense that there's different parts of you or different aspects, and that some of those have are traumatized and then have traumatizing ways of relating. And the model that we've come across recently that's very simple but really helps us is this idea that from developmental trauma, you know, that the good kind of experiences are when we were met by others growing up and when our emotions were held and heard by adults, so parents or caregivers, and when we had that sense of being met and being looked after. And then the bad experiences were all those experiences, like you said, Alex, earlier, that where we didn't get met or we didn't get held or heard. And the idea in this model by Ronald Fairbairn, it was, is that we create this kind of central self out of all those good experiences who's kind of in up here. And then below in the shadow or the unconscious, there's two selves. There's the needy self who's always trying to get the good back, who holds all our experiences of losing that good met experience, and is very scared of losing it again, but always trying to get it back. And that's a lot of that anxious attachment kind of you were talking about. And then we also put away in the unconscious the rejecting self, yeah, who contains everything bad we met in the other, all those experiences of not being met, and also everything we were told was bad in ourselves. And that really maps onto what you were saying, the inner child and the inner teen, or the inner child and the inner critic. And the needy self is kind of desperately trying to get it back all the time. But underneath is that self that carries all the shame, that believes that there is something wrong with us. And the rejecting self is also the rejected. So they're kind of the one who blames out, but also the one who shoots all the anger in at us. And understanding those two, and those two having quite a lot of parts, as you said, parts within parts, you know, it's been for us a really deep learning of trying to bring those two out of the unconscious into the light, really, and understand all our mechanisms. And we have certainly found that our relating has become a lot less traumatized and traumatizing as, for example, the needy self learns to feel connection with all kinds of people and all kinds of relating, rather than going after like the one true, you know, that's gonna rescue him finally. And the rejected self, you know, is learning what her capacities are in the world, that, you know, she's not all bad, that she includes a lot of clarity and a lot of power and a lot of compassion, actually. So I'm just, yeah, there's a lot of materials in our book and then also on our website around how you might do these kind of plural journeys. But I can so encourage people to kind of do those journeys in therapy or in support groups like 12-step or in their spiritual practice, or, you know, in their relationships, starting to learn how to use this language. It's just really helpful.
Yeah, and I think what's helpful about that, it's also accepting our complexity and accepting each other's complexity. You know, I think there's this idea, you know, and I love social media, don't get me wrong. I think there's amazing things that we got in from the internet and social media. And also sometimes everything can be reduced to a sound bite, right? And it makes it sound like here's a list of red flags in relationships, yeah. Or here is like, you know, all the things that you deserve to be loved in a certain way. And I'm like, yeah, so does everybody else though, right? So the reality is the relationship is so much more nuanced and complex that we can sum up in a quick reel or a quick TikTok, mm-hmm. and not saying that those are bad. So there's a lot of really amazing education that's going out there and community building. But I think it can give this idea that there are ideal relationships, that there are things that are red flags at all times, or people that are always toxic, right? And actually, there's so much more complexity. Our inner landscapes, you know, yeah. are so much more complex. And so even like how much attention are we paying to the relationship with ourselves? Because we've been talking about relationships with other people. But for me, I'm in this phase of healing in my 50s where I'm like, hang on a minute, how's my relationship with myself going? Because am I constantly trying to get my needs met through other people, right? Developmental trauma often makes us feel like there is a core of unlovability, I call it, right? Somehow yeah. we're unlovable, everything we touch turns to crap, you know, we couldn't possibly be loved. And so there's almost an element of looking for validation and rescue from outside ourselves because we feel so unlovable. But then if somebody loves us, first of all, what's wrong with them for loving us when we're unlovable? Or if there's nothing wrong with them because we're idealizing them, when is that a shoe going to drop and when they're going to realize that we are bad and unlovable, right? And so if we don't address that core of unlovability that so many of us with developmental trauma experience, we're never going to be fully satisfied when relating to others because we're trying to meet needs that ultimately need to be met within our system. And I'm not saying this is not the you can't love others until you love yourself kind of thing, because again, that is too simplistic. Yeah. It is much more complicated. We get hurt in relationship and we heal in relationship. We actually do need to feel love from others to also learn to love ourselves. So again, it's a both end. It's not one comes before the other. It's not linear, but there needs to be time and effort that we spend on the relationship with ourselves and not just the relationship with other people.
Absolutely. And I think that, you know, again, really up until about 5 years ago, I think what we thought of as an I at the time would have been like loving yourself. It doesn't even compute. Like, how could a self mm-hmm. love a self? And this plurality has opened up like how that might be possible, you know, because you can cultivate aspects of yourself that they might call parental selves or witnessing selves or holding mm-hmm. selves, who can kind of love the ones who are more traumatized. And again, as we're finding, then it becomes actually more reciprocal relationships and more like a team where everybody loves and respects everybody else. And again, once you have that model internally, it is much easier to sort of get that everyone's that complex and to realize, oh, you know, when that person said they love you forever, they were talking from that needy self, and it's like it's understandable that same person then another time was being really kind of avoidant with you because, well, then they were in the rejecting self. And you know that everyone is that complicated, so we're not, again, being so confused by other people's relationship yes. trauma, and we're able to understand it and, you know, treat ourselves and others as that complex, and recognize what we can kind of actually give ourselves as well as giving to others.
And I think when we can more easily recognize that, we also know our needs better and we can ask and receive care more easily from others. Because sometimes we know we want to be loved, but what does that mean, right? But if I know what gives me all of myself, like pleasure and joy, then I can ask for it from others, right? It's like if I know that like having fresh flowers when I'm feeling down and this specific tea is what brings me joy, then I can also more easily say to others, this is how I like to be loved. This is how I like to be cared for, because I know what that what feels nourishing for me. But often we're kind of trying to piecemeal it from popular culture or try to adapt to what people give us without actually really knowing ourselves and having that deep relationship with ourselves.
I really appreciate how y'all have brought in the complexity of humans and of relationships, right? And of course, it makes sense if each human is complex and made up of different parts or different selves, and then relating with another human, who is also definitely made up of different parts and different selves, right? So of course, it's complex. And then again, the importance of the relationship with oneself, and the more we get to know about how our relationship with ourselves and how our do's and don'ts in relating, the more we can communicate that and share that, the more we get to know our triggers and like what supports us and what we need in what given moment, the more we can communicate that. So I really appreciate you bringing this in. I just want to make a slight clarification perhaps for the audience, because you were both talking about multiple selves in a slightly different way, right? So Alex, you were talking very much specifically around like multiple parts of oneself. And you were talking about, you know, we can have our internal child, we can have parental voices, we can have teenage parts, we can have all these different parts. And then those different parts of ourselves, some might work really well with someone else's parts, right? And then there might also be like parts that don't get on so well with someone else's parts. So you're talking perhaps like child and child might not work, or teenager and teenager. But then I think sometimes also what happens is if we're in a childlike state, then the other might become a parent because they might be responding to where we're at, and vice versa. So that's also why dynamics can play out. And often, you know, we cast people in our lives who are going to play out those patterns for us. So we often also end up, for example, attracting someone who, when they're in a parental mode, might mirror like a parent that we had, and we'll go into child mode or vice versa, right? And so again, when we're relating from a very like adult mature self, then it might work, and then there are moments where it doesn't. And again, MJ, you also talked about that contradiction, right? Where someone might say one thing 1 minute, and then 2 days later or 2 hours later they're saying almost the opposite, and it feels like what how can this be the same person? And again, if we recognize the complexity of humans and the different parts, then it makes sense that they're not, you know. And again, some of these parts are often traumatized or frozen in time, and others less so. And then MJ, I really want to bring in this piece around plurality that you were sharing as well, because it's a different flavor to the, you know, and it takes this part work, or the multiple selves work, one step further, where you talk about being plural. So you use, for example, we and us when referring to MJ as a system, right? And you use the term system, which is a bit different to what you, Alex, were talking about. So just for listeners who are unfamiliar with this plurality work, which is less common, I think, and less shared as the part work, I just wanted to make that distinction that when MJ, you're talking, I know you mentioned, for example, at the moment having five selves, and then again, that they're connected, you know, these five selves to like the five, or to the different parts that Alex was talking about, but it is taking it, it is a slightly different thing. I'm wondering if you want to add a bit more about that, but I'm also aware of time, so.
Yeah, well, only briefly. I suppose, you know, I think we're still having these conversations culturally. We're still only beginning to sort of understand that plurality of self, and maybe we could see it as a spectrum for people where it's a bit more metaphorical to those of us who very much experience, you know, five selves, or however many selves. And so you can go and look online at sort of plural system communities where they talk about this. There's also, you know, people who have experiences of dissociative identity disorder and would define as somebody with DID, where it's definitely very trauma linked and very much experiences of different selves. So, you know, there's a nice book called Your Symphony of Selves, which I'd recommend, where they talk about all the different understandings and theories and a lot of different cultures. As Alex said, many cultures have understandings of self as plural. But I guess it's just as with all things, we mustn't kind of put our experience on anyone else, because people have very different ways of experiencing plurality, again, from the sort of metaphorical to the very vivid, and from the kind of trauma related to actually being quite a sacred experience, for example, and many other spectrums. So just like everything, plurality is also plural. And we've got a few resources on our website about plurality if people want to read more.
Thank you for explaining that. And I really appreciate you bringing it in as a spectrum, right? Because I think every single person can relate to some form of plurality, whether it's just recognizing different parts of oneself or recognizing when we're feeling younger or older, that question, how old do you feel right now? My mom used to ask me this all the time growing up and as a teenager, sometimes still does. And again, you know, like the other day, like, So I transitioned relatively recently. I identify as non-binary. And then I have these different like alter egos and I play with gender expression. So the other night I got dressed up in drag for my friend's birthday and it was super fun. And I chose a different name and I had a different voice and different mannerisms. And I embraced my femininity in a very different way to like before I transitioned, for example. So for me, and I'm naming this just to give another experience of plurality and selves, right? Where we can have alter egos. Then I sometimes do burlesque and I have a burlesque alter ego who is different to my drag alter ego who also has a different name and is, you know, and has a, and then there's a drag king alter ego. I have a lot of alter egos, but for me those are very much external. They're to do with like my gender expression and how I'm perceived in the world and how I present and how I play up certain parts of me and certain feelings and certain, you know. And then again there's the like you say, there's the actual plurality of feeling within oneself completely, fully, I don't want to use the word fleshed out because that might not work in this situation, but fully formed different beings. And then again, as Alex was talking, there's the different parts and the more, you know, and as you said, MJ, there's the more trauma related, there's, and then there's the more spiritual selves and there's all these different elements. And so it's a really complex, once again, that word coming in a lot in today's conversation. It's a complex topic. And unfortunately, we don't have time to go into it anymore today, but I hope to have the occasion to go into it more fully. MJ, you and I actually did a whole interview on plurality on a previous edition of the Trauma Super Conference, which people can check out on the Conscious Life platform. People can also find the interview the three of us did together for the Heal Toxic Relationship Conference there, which is how to understand your toxic relationships, where we also talked about your upcoming book and other elements therein, and which is very like related to today's conversation. So I recommend people check that out. And then on this conference, there is many of the interviews that I have named throughout this conversation. Alex and Megjon, thank you so much for your time today. I wish we had more of it. How can people find out about your work?
Absolutely. Well, I'm very easy to find online because my last name is pretty unique. So if you go to my website, alexyantafi.com, it's all there. All the books are there. If you want to follow me on social media, I'm mostly on Instagram nowadays, at xtaffi, X-T-A-F-F-I. At some point, maybe I'll start the TikTok, who knows. But you can find my work there. And I hope that people can relate to one another with curiosity, honoring each other's and their complexity and with intentionality. MJ?
Yeah, again, unusual first name in our case. So Megjon Barker. Googling that will get you to our website, rewritingtherules.com, where there's a lot of free zines and books that you can download. And then, yeah, the book with Alex, How to Understand Your Relationship, should be out next year with Jessica Kingsley. But we have written a number of other books with Jessica Kingsley. So if you want to check out their website, it's a really good place for resources around particularly gender, sexuality and neurodivergence.
Fantastic. Thank you so much for your time today. This has been great as always.
Thank you.
Thank you.